After an hour of sliding proposals and offers and counteroffers across Mulholland's desk, Mitch had increased the package to $8 million, and the old man's lawyer said he might consider 15. Mitch politely repacked his attaché case, and Mulholland politely escorted him to the door. They promised to meet again in a week. They shook hands like best friends. The elevator stopped on the 5th floor, and Tammy walked casually inside. It was empty, except for Mitch. When the door closed, he said, "Any problems?" "Nope. 2 copies are locked away." "How long did it take?" 30 minutes. It stopped on the 4th floor, and she picked up the empty briefcase. "Noon tomorrow?" she asked. "Yes," he replied. The door opened, and she disappeared onto the 4th floor. He rode alone to the lobby, which was empty except for the same security guard. Mitchell McDear, attorney and counselor at law, hurried from the building with a heavy briefcase in each hand and walked importantly back to his office. The celebration of Abby's 25th birthday was rather subdued. Through the dim candlelight in a dark corner of Grisanti's, they whispered and tried to smile at each other. It was difficult. Somewhere at that moment in the restaurant, an invisible FBI agent was holding a cassette tape that he would insert into a cigarette machine in the lounge at precisely 9 o'clock, and Mitch was supposed to be there seconds later to retrieve it without being seen or caught by the bad guys, whoever they were and whatever they looked like. And the tape would reveal just how much cold, hard cash the McDears would receive in return for evidence and a subsequent life on the run. They picked at their food, tried to smile and carry on an extended conversation, but mainly they fidgeted and glanced at their watches. The dinner was brief. By 8:45, they were finished with the plates. Mitch left in the direction of the restroom, and he stared into the dark lounge as he walked by. The cigarette machine was in the corner, exactly where it should be. They ordered coffee, and at exactly 9, Mitch returned to the lounge, to the machine, where he nervously inserted 6 quarters and pulled the lever under Marlboro lights, in memory of Eddie Lomax. He quickly reached into the tray, took the cigarettes, and, fishing around in the darkness, found the cassette tape. The pay telephone next to the machine rang, and he jumped. He turned and surveyed the lounge. It was empty except for 2 men at the bar watching the television behind and above the bartender. Drunk laughter exploded from a dark corner far away. Abby watched every step and move until he sat across from her. She raised her eyebrows. "And?" "I got it. Your basic black Sony cassette tape." Mitch sipped coffee and smiled innocently while quickly surveying the crowded dining room. No one was watching. No one cared. He handed the check and the American Express card to the waiter. "We're in a hurry," he said rudely. The waiter returned within seconds. Mitch scribbled his name. The BMW was indeed wired. Heavily wired. Terrence's gang had very quietly and very thoroughly examined it with magnifying glasses while waiting for the Greyhound 4 days earlier. Expertly wired, with terribly expensive equipment capable of hearing and recording the slightest sniffle or cough. But the bugs could only listen and record. They could not track. Mitch thought that was awfully nice of them, just to listen but not follow the movements of the BMW. It left the parking lot of Grisanti's with no conversation between its occupants. Abby carefully opened a portable tape recorder and placed the cassette inside. She handed Mitch the earphones, which he stuck onto his head. She pushed the play button. She watched him as he listened and drove aimlessly toward the interstate. The voice belonged to Terrence. "Hello, Mitch. Today is Tuesday, March 9th, sometime after 9 p.m. Happy birthday to your lovely wife." This tape will run about 10 minutes, and I instruct you to listen to it carefully, once or twice, then dispose of it. I had a face-to-face meeting with Director Voyles last Sunday and briefed him on everything. By the way, I enjoyed the bus ride. Director Voyles is very pleased with the way things are going, but he thinks we've talked long enough. He wants to cut a deal, and rather quickly. He explained to me in no uncertain terms that we have never paid $3 million and we're not about to pay it to you. He cussed a lot, but to make a long story short, Director Voyles said we could pay $1 million cash, no more. He said the money would be deposited in a Swiss bank and no one, not even the IRS, would ever know about it. $1 million tax-free. That's our best deal, and Voyle said you can go to hell if you said no. We're going to bust that little firm, Mitch, with or without you. Mitch smiled grimly and stared at the traffic racing past them on the I-240 loop. Abby watched for a sign, a signal, a grunt or groan, anything to indicate good news or bad. She said nothing. The voice continued, "We'll take care of you, Mitch. You'll have access to FBI protection any time you think you need it. We'll check on you periodically if you want. And if you want to move on to another city after a few years, we'll take care of it. You can move every 5 years if you want. We'll pick up the tab and find jobs for you. Good jobs with the VA or Social Security or Postal Service. Voyle said we'd even find you a high-paying job with a private government contractor. You name it, Mitch, and it's yours. Of course, we'll provide new identities for you and your wife, and you can change every year if you desire. No problem. Or if you got a better idea, we'll listen. You want to live in Europe or Australia, just say so. You'll get special treatment. I know we're promising a lot, Mitch, but we're dead serious, and we'll put it in writing. We'll pay $1 million in cash, tax-free, and set you up wherever you choose. So that's the deal. And in return, you must hand us the firm and the Moraltos. We'll talk about that later. For now, your time is up. Voyles is breathing down my neck, and things must happen quickly. Call me at that number Thursday night at 9 from the payphone next to the men's restroom in Houston's on Poplar. So long, Mitch. He sliced a finger across his throat, and Abby pushed the stop button, then rewind. He handed her the earphones, and she began to listen intently. It was an innocent walk in the park. Two lovebirds holding hands and strolling casually through the cool, clear moonlight. They stopped by a cannon and gazed at the majestic river inching ever so slowly toward New Orleans. The same cannon where the late Eddie Lomax once stood in a sleet storm and delivered one of his last investigative reports. Abby held the cassette in her hand and watched the river below. She had listened to it twice and refused to leave it in the car, where who knows who might snatch it. After weeks of practicing silence and then speaking only outdoors, words were becoming difficult. "You know, Abby," Mitch finally said as he tapped the wooden wheel of the cannon, "I've always wanted to work with the post office. I had an uncle once who was a rural mail carrier. That would be neat." It was a gamble, this attempt at humor. But it worked. She hesitated for 3 seconds, then laughed slightly, and he could tell she indeed thought it was funny. "Yeah, and I could mop floors in a VA hospital." "You wouldn't have to mop floors. You could change bedpans. Something meaningful, something inconspicuous. We'd live in a neat little white frame house on Maple Street in Omaha. I'd be Harvey, and you'd be Thelma, and we'd need a short, unassuming last name." "Poe," Abby added. "That's great. Harvey and Thelma Poe. the Poe family. We'd have $1 million in the bank, but couldn't spend a dime because everyone on Maple Street would know it, and then we'd become different, which is the last thing we want. I'd get a nose job. But your nose is perfect. Abby's nose is perfect. But what about Thelma's? We'd have to get it fixed, don't you think? Yeah, I suppose. He was immediately tired of the humor and became quiet. Abby stepped in front of him, and he draped his arms over her shoulders. They watched a tug quietly push 100 barges under the bridge. An occasional cloud dimmed the moonlight, and the cool winds from the west rose intermittently, then dissipated. "Do you believe, Terence?" Abby asked. "In what way?" "Let's suppose you do nothing. Do you believe one day they'll eventually infiltrate the firm?" "I'm afraid not to believe." "So we take the money and run?" "It's easier for me to take the money and run, Abby. I have nothing to leave behind. For you, it's different. You'll never see your family again." "Where would we go?" "I do not know. But I wouldn't want to stay in this country. The feds cannot be trusted entirely. I'll feel safer in another country, but I won't tell Terence." "What's the next step?" "We cut a deal, then quickly go about the job of gathering enough information to sink the ship. I have no idea what they want, but I can find it for them. When Terence has enough, we disappear. We take our money, get our nose jobs, and disappear."
"How much money?"
"More than $1 million. They're playing games with the money. It's all negotiable."
"How much will we get?"
$2 million cash, tax-free, not a dime less."
"Will they pay it?"
"Yes, but that's not the question. The question is, will we take it and run?" She was cold, and he draped his coat over her shoulders. He held her tightly.
"It's a rotten deal, Mitch," she said. "But at least we'll be together."
"The name's Harvey, not Mitch."
"Do you think we'll be safe, Harvey?"
"We're not safe here."
"I don't like it here. I'm lonely and scared."
"I'm tired of being a lawyer."
"Let's take the money and haul ass."
"You've got a deal, Thelma." She handed the cassette tape to him. He glanced at it, then threw it far below, beyond Riverside Drive, in the direction of the river. They held hands and strolled quickly through the park toward the BMW parked on Front Street. Chapter 24. For only the second time in his career, Mitch was allowed to visit the palatial dining room on the fifth floor. Avery's invitation came with the explanation that the partners were all quite impressed with the 71 hours per week he had averaged in billing for the month of February, and thus they wished to offer the small reward of lunch. It was an invitation no associate could turn down, regardless of schedules and meetings and clients and deadlines and all the other terribly important and urgently critical aspects of careers at Bendini, Lambert, and Locke. Never in history had an associate said no to an invitation to the dining room. Each received 2 invitations per year. Records were kept. Mitch had 2 days to prepare for it. His first impulse was to decline, and when Avery first mentioned it, 12 lame excuses crossed his mind. Eating and smiling and chatting and fraternizing with criminals, regardless of how rich and polished, was less attractive than sharing a bowl of soup with a homeless down at the bus station. But to say no would be a grievous breach of tradition. And as things were going,
His movements were already suspicious enough. So he sat with his back to the window and forced smiles and small talk in the direction of Avery and Royce McKnight and, of course, Oliver Lambert. He knew he would eat at the same table with those three. Knew it for 2 days. He knew they would watch him carefully but nonchalantly, trying to detect any loss of enthusiasm or cynicism or hopelessness. Anything, really. He knew they would hang on his every word, regardless of what he said. He knew they would lavish praise and promises upon his weary shoulders. Oliver Lambert had never been more charming. 71 hours a week for a February for an associate was a firm record, he said, as Roosevelt served prime rib. All the partners were amazed and delighted, he explained softly while glancing around the room. Mitch forced a smile and sliced his serving. The other partners, amazed or indifferent, were talking idly and concentrating on the food. Mitch counted 18 active partners and 7 retirees, those with the khakis and sweaters and relaxed looks about them. "You have remarkable stamina, Mitch," Royce McKnight said with a mouthful. He nodded politely. "Yes, yes, I practice my stamina all the time," he thought to himself. As much as possible, he kept his mind off Joe Hodge and Marty Kaczynski and the other 3 dead lawyers memorialized on the wall downstairs. But it was impossible to keep his mind off the pictures of the girl in the sand, and he wondered if they all knew. Had they all seen the pictures? Passed them around during one of these little lunches when it was just the partners and no guests? DeVasher had promised to keep them to himself, but what's a promise from a thug? Of course they'd seen them. Voiles said every partner and most of the associates were in on the conspiracy. For a man with no appetite, he managed the food nicely. He even buttered and devoured an extra roll just to appear normal. Nothing wrong with his appetite. "So you and Abby are going to the Caymans next week," Oliver Lambert said. "Yes, it's her spring break, and we booked one of the condos 2 months ago. Looking forward to it." "It's a terrible time to go," Avery said in disgust. "We're a month behind right now." "We're always a month behind, Avery. So what's another week? I guess you want me to take my files with me?" "Not a bad idea. I always do." "Don't do it, Mitch," Oliver Lambert said in mock protest. "This place will be standing when you return. You and Abby deserve a week to yourselves." "You'll love it down there," Royce McKnight said, as if Mitch had never been and that thing on the beach didn't happen, and no one knew anything about any photographs. "When do you leave?" Lambert asked. "Sunday morning, early."
"Are you taking the Lear?"
"No. Delta nonstop." Lambert and McKnight exchanged quick looks that Mitch was not supposed to see. There were other looks from the other tables, occasional quick glances filled with curiosity that Mitch had caught since he entered the room. He was there to be noticed. "Do you scuba dive?" asked Lambert, still thinking about the Lear versus the Delta nonstop. "No, but we plan to do some snorkeling." "There's a guy on Rum Point, on the north end, name of Adrian Bench, who's got a great dive lodge and will certify you in 1 week. It's a hard week, a lot of instruction, but it's worth it." In other words, stay away from A-Banks, Mitch thought. "What's the name of the lodge?" he asked. "Rum Point Divers. Great place." Mitch frowned intelligently, as if making a mental note of this helpful advice. Suddenly, Oliver Lambert was hit with sadness.
"Be careful, Mitch. It brings back memories of Marty and Joe."
Avery and McKnight stared at their plates in a split-second memorial to the dead boys. Mitch swallowed hard and almost sneered at Oliver Lambert. But he kept a straight face, even managed to look sad with the rest of them. Marty and Joe, and their young widows and fatherless children. Marty and Joe, two young, wealthy lawyers expertly killed and removed before they could talk. Marty and Joe, two promising sharks eaten by their own. Voyles had told Mitch to think of Marty and Joe whenever he saw Oliver Lambert. And now, for a mere $1 million, he was expected to do what Marty and Joe were about to do without getting caught. Perhaps a year from now, the next new associate would be sitting here and watching the saddened partners talk about young Mitch McDear and his remarkable stamina and what a hell of a lawyer he would have been but for the accident. How many would they kill? He wanted $2 million, plus a couple of other items. After an hour of important talk and good food, the lunch began breaking up as partners excused themselves, spoke to Mitch, and left the room. They were proud of him, they said. He was their brightest star of the future. The future of Bendini, Lambert, and Locke. He smiled and thanked them. About the time Roosevelt served the banana cream pie and coffee, Tammy Greenwood Hempfill of Greenwood Services parked her dirty brown rabbit behind the shiny Peugeot in the St. Andrew's Episcopal School parking lot. She left the motor running. She took four steps, stuck a key into the trunk of the Peugeot, and removed the heavy black briefcase. She slammed the trunk and sped away in the rabbit. From a small window in the teacher's lounge, Abby sipped coffee and stared through the trees, across the playground and into the parking lot in the distance. She could barely see her car. She smiled and checked her watch. 12:30, as planned. Tammy weaved her way carefully through the noon traffic in the direction of downtown. Driving was tedious when watching the rearview mirror. As usual, she saw nothing. She parked in her designated place across the street from the Cotton Exchange building. There were 9 files in this load. She arranged them neatly on the folding table and began making copies. Sigalas Partners, Letty Plunk Trust, Handyman Hardware, and 2 files bound loosely with a thick rubber band and marked Avery's files. She ran 2 copies of every sheet of paper in the files and meticulously put them back together. In a ledger book, she entered the date, time, and name of each file. There were now 29 entries. He said there would eventually be about 40. She placed 1 copy of each file into the locked and hidden cabinet in the closet, then repacked the briefcase with the original files and 1 copy of each. Pursuant to his instructions, a week earlier she had rented in her name a 12x12 storage room at the Summer Avenue Mini Storage. It was 14 miles from downtown, and 30 minutes later she arrived and unlocked number 38C. In a small cardboard box, she placed the other copies of the 9 files and scribbled the date on the end of the flap. She placed it next to 3 other boxes on the floor. At exactly 3 p.m., she wheeled into the parking lot, stopped behind the Peugeot, opened its trunk, and left the briefcase where she'd found it. Seconds later, Mitch stepped from the front door of the Bendini building and stretched his arms. He breathed deeply and gazed up and down Front Street. A lovely spring day. 3 blocks to the north and 9 floors up, in the window, he noticed the blinds had been pulled all the way down. The signal. Good. Everything's fine. He smiled to himself and returned to his office. At 3 o'clock the next morning, Mitch eased out of bed and quietly pulled on a pair of faded jeans, flannel law school shirt, white insulated socks, and a pair of old work boots. He wanted to look like a truck driver. Without a word, he kissed Abby, who was awake, and left the house. East Meadowbrook was deserted, as were all the streets between home and the interstate. Surely they would not follow him at this hour. He drove Interstate 55 south for 25 miles to Senatobia, Mississippi. A busy all-night truck stop called the 455 shone brightly 100 yards from the four-lane. He darted through the trucks to the rear where 100 semis were parked for the night. He stopped next to the truck wash bay and waited. A dozen 18-wheelers inched and weaved around the pumps. A black guy wearing a Falcons football cap stepped from around the corner and stared at the BMW. Mitch recognized him as the agent in the bus terminal in Knoxville. He killed the engine and stepped from the car. "McDear?" the agent asked. "Of course. Who else?" "Where's Terrence?" "Inside in a booth by the window. He's waiting." Mitch opened the door and handed the keys to the agent. "Where are you taking it?"
"Down the road a little piece. We'll take care of it. You were clean coming out of Memphis. Relax."
He climbed into the car, eased between 2 diesel pumps, and headed for the interstate. Mitch watched his little BMW disappear as he entered the truck stop cafe. It was 3:45. The noisy room was filled with heavy, middle-aged men drinking coffee and eating store-bought pies. They picked their teeth with colored toothpicks and talked of bass fishing and politics back at the terminal. Many spoke with loud northern twangs. Merle Haggard wailed from the jukebox. The lawyer moved awkwardly toward the rear until he saw in an unlit corner a familiar face hidden beneath aviator's sunshades and the same Michigan State baseball cap. Then the face smiled. Terrence was holding a menu and watching the front door. Mitch slid into the booth.
"Hello, good buddy," Terrence said. "How's the truckin'?"
"Wonderful. I think I prefer the bus, though."
"Next time we'll try a train or something. Just for variety." "Laney, get your car."
"Laney?
The black dude. He's an agent, you know."
"We haven't been properly introduced."
"Yes, he's got my car. Where is he taking it?"
"Down the interstate. He'll be back in an hour or so.
We'll try to have you on the road by 5 so you can be at the office by 6. We'd hate to mess up your day."
"It's already shut to hell." A partially crippled waitress named Dot ambled by and demanded to know what they wanted.
"Just coffee."
A surge of roadway drivers swarmed in the front door and filled up the cafe. Merle could barely be heard.
"So how are the boys at the office?" Terrence asked cheerfully.
"Everything's fine. The meters are ticking as we speak, and everyone's getting richer. Thanks for asking."
"No problem."
"How's my old pal Voyles doing?" Mitch asked.
"He's quite anxious, really. He called me twice today and repeated for the 10th time his desire to have an answer from you. Said you'd had plenty of time and all that. I told him to relax. Told him about our little roadside rendezvous tonight, and he got real excited. I'm supposed to call him in 4 hours, to be exact."
"Tell him $1 million won't do it, Terrence. You boys like to brag about spending billions fighting organized crime, so I say throw a little my way. What's a couple of million cash to the federal government?"
"So it's a couple of million now."
"Damn right it's a couple of million, and not a dime less. I want $1 million now and $1 million later. I'm in the process of copying all of my files, and I should be finished in a few days. Legitimate files, I think. If I gave them to anyone, I'd be permanently disbarred. So when I give them to you, I want the first million. Let's just call it good faith money.
How do you want it paid?
Deposited in an account in a bank in Zurich, but we'll discuss the details later. Dot slid two saucers onto the table and dropped two mismatched cups on them. She poured from a height of 3 feet and splashed coffee in all directions.
Free refills, she grunted, and left.
And the second million? Terence asked, ignoring the coffee. When you and I and Voyles decide I've supplied you with enough documents to get the indictments, then I get half. After I testify for the last time, I get the other half. That's incredibly fair, Terence.
It is. You've got a deal.
Mitch breathed deeply and felt weak. A deal. A contract. An agreement. One that could never be put in writing, but one that was terribly enforceable nonetheless. He sipped the coffee but didn't taste it. They had agreed on the money. He was on a roll. Keep pushing.
And there's one other thing, Terence.
The head lowered and turned slightly to the right.
Yeah?
Mitch leaned closer, resting on his forearms.
It won't cost you a dime, and you boys can pull it off with no sweat.
Okay?
I'm listening.
My brother Ray is at Brushy Mountain. 7 years until parole. I want him out.
That's ridiculous, Mitch. We can do a lot of things, but we damn sure can't parole state prisoners. Federal, maybe, but not state. No way.
Listen to me, Terence, and listen good. If I hit the road with the mafia on my tail, my brother goes with me. Sort of like a package deal. And I know if Director Voyles wants him out of prison, he'll get out of prison. I know that. Now, you boys just figure out a way to make it happen.
But we have no authority to interfere with state prisoners.
Mitch smiled and returned to his coffee. James Earl Ray escaped from Brushy Mountain, and he had no help from the outside.
Oh, that's great. We attack the prison like commandos and rescue your brother. Beautiful.
Don't play dumb with me, Terence. It's not negotiable.
All right. I'll see what I can do.
Anything else? Any more surprises?
No.
Just questions about where we go and what we do. Where do we hide initially? Where do we hide during the trials? Where do we live for the rest of our lives? Just minor questions like that.
We can discuss it later.
What did Hodge and Kaczynski tell you?
Not enough.
We've got a notebook, a rather thick notebook, in which we've accumulated and indexed everything we know about the Moraltos and the firm. Most of it's Moralto crap. Their organization, key people, illegal activities, and so on. You need to read it all before we start to work.
Which, of course, will be after I've received the first million.
Of course.
When can we see your files?
In about a week. I've managed to copy 4 files that belong to someone else. I may get my hands on a few more of those.
Who's doing the copying?
None of your business.
Terence thought for a second and let it pass.
How many files?
Between 40 and 50.
I have to sneak them out a few at a time. Some I've worked on for 8 months, others only a week or so. As far as I can tell, they're all legitimate clients.
How many of these clients have you personally met?
2 or 3.
Don't bet they're all legitimate.
Hodge told us about some dummy files, or sweat files, as they're known to the partners, that have been around for years, and every new associate cuts his teeth on them. heavy files that require hundreds of hours and make the rookies feel like real lawyers. Sweat files. That's what Hodge said. It's an easy game, Mitch. They lure you with the money. They smother you with work that looks legitimate and, for the most part, probably is legitimate. Then after a few years, you've unwittingly become a part of the conspiracy. You're nailed, and there's no getting out. Even you, Mitch. You started work in July, 8 months ago, and you've probably already touched a few of the dirty files. You didn't know it, had no reason to suspect it, but they've already set you up.
2 million, Terrence. 2 million and my brother. Terrence sipped the lukewarm coffee and ordered a piece of coconut pie as Dot came within earshot. He glanced at his watch and surveyed the crowd of truckers, all smoking cigarettes and drinking coffee and gossiping. He adjusted the sunglasses. So what do I tell Mr. Voiles?
Tell him we ain't got a deal until he agrees to get Ray out of prison.
No deal, Terrence.
We can probably work something out.
I'm confident you can.
When do you leave for the Caymans?
Early Sunday. Why?
Just curious, that's all.
Well, I'd like to know how many different groups will be following me down there.
Is that asking too much?
I'm sure we'll attract a crowd, and frankly, we had hoped for a little privacy.
Farm condo.
Of course.
Forget privacy. It's probably got more wires than a switchboard, maybe even some cameras.
That's comforting. We might stay a couple of nights at Abank's Dive Lodge. If you boys are in the neighborhood, stop by for a drink.
Very funny. If we're there, it'll be for a reason, and you won't know it.
Terrence ate the pie in 3 bites. He left $2 on the table and they walked to the dark rear of the truck stop. The dirty asphalt pavement vibrated under the steady hum of an acre of diesel engines. They waited in the dark.
I'll talk to Voiles in a few hours, Terrence said. Why don't you and your wife take a leisurely Saturday afternoon drive tomorrow?
Any place in particular?
Yeah. There's a town called Holly Springs, 30 miles east of here.
Old place, full of antebellum homes and Confederate history. Women love to drive around and look at the old mansions. Make your appearance around 4 o'clock and we'll find you. Our buddy Laney will be driving a bright red Chevy Blazer with Tennessee plates. Follow him. We'll find a place and talk.
Is it safe?
Trust us. If we see or smell something, we'll break off. Drive around town for an hour, and if you don't see Laney, grab a sandwich and go back home. You'll know they were too close. We won't take chances.
Thanks. A great bunch of guys.
Laney eased around the corner in the BMW and jumped out.
Everything's clear. No trace of anyone.
Good, Terrence said.
See you tomorrow, Mitch.
Happy trucking.
They shook hands.
It's not negotiable, Terrence, Mitch said again.
You can call me Wayne.
See you tomorrow.
Chapter 25.
The black thunderheads and driving rain had long since cleared the tourists from 7 Mile Beach when the McDears, soaked and tired, arrived at the luxury condominium duplex. Mitch backed the rented Jeep over the curb, across the small lawn, and up to the front door. Unit B. His first visit had been to Unit A. They appeared to be identical, except for the paint and trim. The key fit, and they grabbed and threw luggage as the clouds burst and the rain grew thicker. Once inside and dry, they unpacked in the master bedroom upstairs with a long balcony facing the wet beach.
Cautious with their words, they inspected the townhouse and checked out each room and closet. The refrigerator was empty, but the bar was very well stocked. Mitch mixed two drinks, rum and coke, in honor of the islands. They sat on the balcony with their feet in the rain and watched the ocean churn and spill toward the shore. Rumheads was quiet and barely visible in the distance. Two natives sat at the bar, drinking and watching the sea. "That's Rumheads over there," Mitch said, pointing with his drink.
"Rumheads?
I told you about it. It's a hot spot where tourists drink and the locals play dominoes."
"I see."
Abby was unimpressed. She yawned and sank lower into the plastic chair. She closed her eyes.
"Oh, this is great, Abby. Our first trip out of the country, our first real honeymoon, and you're asleep 10 minutes after we hit land."
"I'm tired, Mitch. I packed all night while you were sleeping."
"You packed 8 suitcases. 6 for you and 2 for me. You packed every garment we own. No wonder you were awake all night."
"I don't want to run out of clothes."
"Run out? How many bikinis did you pack? 10? 12?
6. "Great. 1 a day. Why don't you put one on?"
"What?
You heard me.
Go put on that little blue one with high legs and a couple of strings around front. The one that weighs 0.5 gram and costs $60 and your buns hang out when you walk. I want to see it."
"Mitch, it's raining. You've brought me here to this island during the monsoon season. Look at those clouds. Dark and thick and extremely stationary. I won't need any bikinis this week."
Mitch smiled and began rubbing her legs.
"I rather like the rain. In fact, I hope it rains all week. It'll keep us inside, in the bed, sipping rum and trying to hurt each other."
"I'm shocked. You mean you actually want sex? We've already done it once this month."
"Twice."
"I thought you wanted to snorkel and scuba dive all week."
"Nope. There's probably a shark out there waiting for me."
The winds blew harder and the balcony was being drenched.
"Let's go take off our clothes," Mitch said.
After an hour, the storm began to move. The rain slackened, then turned to a soft drizzle. Then it was gone. The sky lightened as the dark, low clouds left the tiny island and headed northeast toward Cuba. Shortly before its scheduled departure over the horizon, the sun suddenly emerged for a brief encore. It emptied the beach cottages and townhomes and condos and hotel rooms as the tourists strolled through the sand toward the water. Rumheads was suddenly packed with dart throwers and thirsty beachcombers. The domino game picked up where it had left off. The reggae band next door at the Palms tuned up.
Mitch and Abby walked aimlessly along the edge of the water in the general direction of Georgetown, away from the spot where the girl had been. He thought of her occasionally, and of the photographs. He had decided she was a pro and had been paid by Devasher to seduce and conquer him in front of the hidden cameras. He did not expect to see her this time. As if on cue, the music stopped. The beach strollers froze and watched. The noise at Rumheads quieted as all eyes turned to watch the sun meet the water. Gray and white clouds, the trailing remnants of the storm, lay low on the horizon and sank with the sun. Slowly they turned shades of orange and yellow and red, pale shades at first, then suddenly, brilliant tones. For a few brief moments, the sky was a canvas, and the sun splashed its awesome array of colors with bold strokes. Then the bright orange ball touched the water and within seconds was gone. The clouds became black and dissipated. a Cayman sunset. With great fear and caution, Abby slowly maneuvered the Jeep through the early morning traffic in the shopping district. She was from Kentucky. She had never driven on the left side of the road for any substantial period of time. Mitch gave directions and watched the rearview mirror. The narrow streets and sidewalks were already crowded with tourists window shopping for duty-free china, crystal, perfume, cameras, and jewelry. Mitch pointed to a hidden side street, and the Jeep darted between two groups of tourists. He kissed her on the cheek. "I'll meet you right here at 5. "Be careful," she said. "I'll go to the bank, then stay on the beach near the condo." He slammed the door and disappeared between two small shops. The alley led to a wider street that led to Hogsty Bay. He ducked into a crowded t-shirt store filled with racks and rows of tourist shirts and straw hats and sunglasses. He selected a gaudy green and orange flowered shirt and a Panama hat. 2 minutes later, he darted from the store into the back seat of a passing taxi. "Airport," he said, "and make it quick. Watch your tail. Someone may be following." The driver made no response, just eased past the bank buildings and out of town. 10 minutes later, he stopped in front of the terminal. "Anybody follow us?" Mitch asked, pulling money from his pocket. "No, man. $4.10. Mitch threw a 5 over the seat and walked quickly into the terminal. The Cayman Airways flight to Cayman Brac would leave at 9. At a gift shop, Mitch bought a cup of coffee and hid between two rows of shelves filled with souvenirs. He watched the waiting area and saw no one. Of course, he had no idea what they looked like, but he saw no one sniffing around and searching for lost people. Perhaps they were following the Jeep or combing the shopping district looking for him. Perhaps. For 75 Cayman dollars, he had reserved the last seat on the 10-passenger, 3-engine Trilander. Abby had made the reservation by payphone the night they arrived. At the last possible second, he jogged from the terminal onto the tarmac and climbed on board. The pilot slammed and locked the doors, and they taxied down the runway. No other planes were visible. A small hangar sat to the right. The 10 tourists admired the brilliant blue sea and said little during the 20-minute flight. As they approached Cayman Brac, the pilot became the tour guide and made a wide circle around the small island. He paid special attention to the tall bluffs that fell into the sea on the east end. Without the bluffs, he said, the island would be as flat as Grand Cayman. He landed the plane softly on a narrow asphalt strip. Next to the small white frame building with the word "Airport" painted on all sides, a clean-cut Caucasian waited and watched the passengers quickly disembark. He was Rick Acklin, special agent, and sweat dripped from his nose and glued his shirt to his back. He stepped slightly forward. "Mitch," he said, almost to himself. Mitch hesitated and then walked over. "Car's out front," Acklin said. "Where's Terrence?" Mitch looked around. "He's waiting." "Does the car have air conditioning?" "Afraid not. Sorry." The car was minus air, power anything, and signal lights. It was a 1974 LTD, and Acklin explained as they followed the dusty road that there simply was not much of a selection of rental cars on Cayman Brac. And the reason the U.S. government had rented the car was because he and Terrence had been unable to find a taxi. They were lucky to find a room on such late notice. The small, neat homes were closer together, and C appeared. They parked in the sand parking lot of an establishment called Brac Divers. An aging pier jutted into the water and anchored 100 boats of all sizes. To the west along the beach, a dozen thatched roof cabins sat 2 feet above the sand and housed divers who came from around the world. Next to the pier was an open-air bar. Nameless, but complete with a domino game and a dartboard. Oak and brass fans hung from the ceiling through the rafters and rotated slowly and silently, cooling the domino players and the bartender. Wayne Terrence sat at a table by himself drinking a Coke and watching a dive crew load 1,000 identical yellow tanks from the pier onto a boat. Even for a tourist, his dress was hysterical. Dark sunglasses with yellow frames, brown straw sandals, obviously brand new, with black socks, a tight Hawaiian luau shirt with 20 loud colors, and a pair of gold gym shorts that were very old and very short and covered little of the shiny, sickly white legs under the table. He waved his Coke at the two empty chairs. "Nice shirt, Terrence," Mitch said in undisguised amusement. "Thanks. You got a real winner yourself. Nice tan, too." "Yeah, yeah. Gotta look the part, you know." The waiter hovered nearby and waited for them to speak. Acklin ordered a Coke. Mitch said he wanted a Coke with a splash of rum in it. All three became engrossed with the dive boat and the divers loading their bulky gear. "What happened in Holly Springs?" Mitch finally asked. "Sorry. We couldn't help it. They followed you out of Memphis and had two cars waiting in Holly Springs. We couldn't get near you." "Did you and your wife discuss the trip before you left?" asked Acklin. "I think so. We probably mentioned it around the house a couple of times." Acklin seemed satisfied. "They were certainly ready for you. A green skylark followed you for about 20 miles, then got lost. We called it off then." Terrence sipped his Coke and said, "Late Saturday night, the Lear left Memphis and flew nonstop to Grand Cayman. We think 2 or 3 of the goons were on board. The plane left early Sunday morning and returned to Memphis." "So they're here and they're following us?" "Of course. They probably had 1 or 2 people on the plane with you and Abby. Might have been men, women, or both. Could have been a black dude or an Oriental woman. Who knows? Remember, Mitch, they have plenty of money. There are 2 that we recognize. One was in Washington when you were there. A blonde fellow, about 40. 6'1", maybe 6'2", with real short hair, almost a crew cut, and real strong, Nordic-looking features. He moves quickly. We saw him yesterday driving a red Escort he got from Coconut Car Rentals on the island. I think I've seen him, Mitch said. Where? Asked Acklin. In a bar in the Memphis airport the night I returned from Washington. I caught him watching me, and I thought at the time that I had seen him in Washington. That's him. He's here. Who's the other one? Tony Verkler, or Two-Ton Tony, as we call him. He's a con with an impressive record of convictions, most of it in Chicago. He's worked for Meralta for years. Weighs about 300 pounds and does a great job of watching people because no one would ever suspect him. He was at Rumhead's last night, Acklin added. Last night? We were there last night. With great ceremony, the dive boat pushed from the pier and headed for open water. Beyond the pier, fishermen in their small catboats pulled their nets and sailors navigated their brightly colored catamarans away from land. After a gentle and dreamy start, the island was awake now. Half the boats tied to the pier had left or were in the process of leaving. "So when did you boys get in town?" Mitch asked, sipping his drink, which was more rum than Coke. "Sunday night," Terrence answered, while watching the dive boat slowly disappear. "Just out of curiosity, how many men do you have on the islands?" 4 men, 2 women, said Terrence. Acklin became mute and deferred all conversation to his supervisor. "And why exactly are you here?" Mitch asked. "Oh, several reasons. Number 1, we wanted to talk to you and nail down our little deal. Director Voiles is terribly anxious about reaching an agreement you can live with. Number two, we want to watch them to determine how many goons are here. We'll spend the week trying to identify these people. The island is small, and it's a good place to observe. And number three, you wanted to work on your suntan. Acklin managed a slight giggle. Terence smiled and then frowned. No, not exactly. We're here for your protection.
My protection?
Yes. The last time I sat at this very table, I was talking to Joe Hodge and Marty Kaczynski. About 9 months ago. The day before they were killed, to be exact.
And you think I'm about to be killed?
No. Not yet. Mitch motioned at the bartender for another drink. The domino game grew heated, and he watched the natives argue and drink beer.
Look, boys, as we speak, the goons, as you call them, are probably following my wife all over Grand Cayman. I'll be sort of nervous until I get back. Now, what about the deal?
Terence left the sea and the dive boat and stared at Mitch. 2 million's fine, and of course it's fine, Terence. We agreed on it, did we not?
Relax, Mitch.
We'll pay 1 million when you turn over all of your files. At that point, there's no turning back, as they say. You're in up to your neck.
Terence, I understand that. It was my suggestion, remember? But that's the easy part. We really don't want your files, because they're clean files. Good files. Legitimate files.
We want the bad files, Mitch. The ones with indictments written all over them. And these files will be much harder to come by. But when you do so, we'll pay another 500,000. And the rest after the last trial.
And my brother?
We'll try. Not good enough, Terence. I want a commitment. We can't promise to deliver your brother. Hell, he's got at least 7 more years.
But he's my brother, Terence. I don't care if he's a serial murderer sitting on death row waiting for his last meal. He's my brother, and if you want me, you have to release him.
I said we'll try, but we can't commit. There's no legal, formal, legitimate way to get him out, so we must try other means.
What if he gets shot during the escape?
Just get him out, Terence.
We'll try.
You'll throw the power and resources of the FBI in assisting my brother in escaping from prison, right, Terence?
You have my word.
Mitch sat back in his chair and took a long sip of his drink. Now, the deal was final. He breathed easier and smiled in the direction of the magnificent Caribbean.
So when do we get your files? Terence asked.
Thought you didn't want them.
They're too clean, remember?
We want the files, Mitch, because when we get the files, then we've got you. You've proved yourself when you hand us your files, your license to practice law, so to speak.
10 to 15 days.
How many files?
Between 40 and 50.
The small ones are 1 inch thick. The big ones wouldn't fit on this table. I can't use the copiers around the office, so we've had to make other arrangements.
Perhaps we could assist in the copying, said Acklin.
Perhaps not. Perhaps if I need your help, perhaps I'll ask for it.
How do you propose to get them to us? Terence asked.
Acklin withdrew again.
Very simple, Wayne. When I've copied them all, and once I get the 1 million where I want it, then I'll hand you a key to a certain little room in the Memphis area, and you can get them in your pickup.
I told you we'd deposit the money in a Swiss bank account, Terence said.
And now I don't want it in a Swiss bank account, okay?
I'll dictate the terms of the transfer, and it'll be done exactly as I say. It's my neck on the line from now on, boys, so I call the shots. Most of them, anyway.
Terence smiled and grunted and stared at the pier.
So you don't trust the Swiss?
Let's just say I have another bank in mind.